I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, and my name is Angie Baldwin. Thank you, thank you, thank you for that wonderful introduction. I am also known as Amanda's mother, so I'm glad to be here in that regard as well. I have two home groups. One home group is the Destin Al-Anon Family Group in Destin, Florida. And my other home group is the Hope Al-Anon Family Group in Dothan, Alabama. Woohoo! I want to thank Lee's Tapes and Lee and thank the Board of Girl Stock for being here today, but also I have participated in this conference 6 of the last 7 years. So I want to thank them for doing what they do so well. I love this conference. I love everything that it stands for. I love this coming together of women and the celebration that we do in our recovery. So I'm very, very happy to be here for another year. I heard someone say one time that Al-Anon was all about relationships, and I would agree that it is about relationships, but I also believe that it's all about hope and it's all about miracles, and I hope to get to share some of that with you this morning. My father was in the military. He was an Army officer, so for me that meant that we were always either packing up to go somewhere, just arriving somewhere, thinking about where we were going to go next, or packing up to leave. That was my life, my whole growing up. My father was not an alcoholic. He truly was a social drinker. I saw him what we would call a little bit tipsy a couple of times in my life, and I loved those times because he would always come in from a military function, and he would go over to the telephone and get out his address book and call all of his old Army buddies, and they would share Army stories with each other. And my father talked very little about his military experience, so I loved hearing him share those stories. My mother was an alcoholic. We had, she and I, a very difficult relationship for most of my growing up. And it was only as I became an adult that that relationship really started to change. My brother, Glenn, is 7 years older than me, and he was a sports athlete par excellence. Every sport he ever tried, he excelled in, beyond excelling. He was a quarterback on the football team and the pitcher on the baseball team and the forward on the basketball team and the captain of the golf team. In any sport, that's where he was. He was also a math and science genius, which I think may have helped him in his sports life. And that was Glenn. And then there was me, and I lived my life in books. I love to read. I've always loved to read. But when I was growing up, I really used those books as an escape. You see, I could go to places in those books, and I could have friends in those books that never, ever left me. Because I learned pretty quickly in a military family that when you say hello, that means you're going to have to say goodbye. And I did not want to say goodbye. So as time went on, I didn't very often say hello. So we looked really good on the outside. If you saw us, you would think, man, I love that family. But on the inside, we were really four islands. We were four islands that kind of just lived on our own little island, and sometimes we'd come together for a little bit, but we just kind of lived on our four islands under the roof of this house. As I grew up in that family, the opposite sex became quite attractive to me. Now, I will tell you what that meant, whether it was male or female, just what meeting people that I liked meant in my life. I can be in a room of 800 people. There can be one alcoholic in that room. Yeah, you know. The heavens open up, the angelic chorus sings, and the sunbeams and moonbeams shine down on that alcoholic. Whether it's male or female, it doesn't matter. Now I'll tell you that this room is glowing right now. Glowing! Woo! And I love that glow. I love that glow. Alcoholics, Al-Anons, I love that glow. And so when I became interested in the opposite sex, I was really interested in that glow with a guy. This is what he was like then. He's kind of tall, nice looking. He'd walk in a room and people would say, oh, look, he's here, he's here. Man, could he tell a story. He could tell a story and make you believe anything just by the way he told it. He knew how to treat a woman when he was dating her. He knew just the right things to say. He knew how to compliment you and make you feel so special. He knew how to make you feel like you were the only person on earth that could really understand him and really be for him. He also didn't know how to handle anger. He didn't know how to handle any emotion. He expressed one, and that was anger, but he expressed it pretty inappropriately. He had either been emotionally and or sexually and or physically abused growing up, either emotionally and or sexually and or physically abused others. He didn't know how to communicate very well about anything that had to do with inside stuff. And he sure didn't know how to handle conflict. And you see, it was many years before I realized one day that he was me. That's who I was. That's who I was. And in addition to those things, I could manipulate most any situation to my advantage. I, as a matter of fact, would get pretty bored with normal. And I liked chaos. So I would create chaos when there wasn't any going on. But I would do it in such a way that I would make you feel like you started the whole thing and have you apologizing to me and making amends to me for what I did. I could lie just as easily as I could tell the truth. I could castrate or crucify you with the words that would come out of my mouth. Now, I'm not proud of that. And I'm very, very grateful due to the program of recovery that I don't have to be that woman today. I can stand before you as a woman of dignity and grace every day if I choose to do that today, because of the program of recovery that I practice. So, his wounded heart would call out to my wounded soul, and we would join hands together, and we would walk off into the sunset to live happily ever after. And I will tell you, for me, it just never worked. It just did not work. Short-term relationships, short-term marriages, they just didn't work. In 1978, I was living in a small town in South Alabama called Andalusia, and I was in a musical, and the name of the musical was Carousel, and I played the lady of the evening in the musical. And those sunbeams and moonbeams shined down on that villain, and his name was Paul. And Paul asked me on a date. We went to a movie, and on the way home, he said, "This is what I heard him say." It's a difference. "I'm going to an AA meeting Saturday night. Would you like to go with me?" So, we had a talk about that conversation years later. What he actually said was, "Angie, I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to an AA meeting Saturday night. Would you like to go with me?" I know that's what he said because I trust and believed in Paul. I know he said that. But I would promise you today still that I did not hear him say, "I'm an alcoholic." You see, that's how denial works in my life. I hear what I want to hear, and I see what I want to see. The week rocked on. I asked my mother to babysit my first marriage. The best thing that happened in that marriage was we had a daughter named Amanda, and she was growing up, and I asked my mother, would she babysit? And she said, sure. And she said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Well, what is AA?" I said, "You know, I don't know." Now, this time I drove dirt track race cars for fun, and I knew that AAA was about cars. So I said, "Well, you know, AAA is about cars, so I'm thinking AA is about cars, too." And she said, "Okay, you know." So Saturday night comes along, and Paul picks me up, and we drive about 20 minutes to another small town in South Alabama called Off Alabama. And we pulled into a church parking lot, and I remember thinking, this is a strange place to have a meeting about cars. And we walked inside, and Paul said, "Now, we're going over here," and he gestured to the right. And he said, "And you're going over here," and he gestured to the left. And when I turned to the left, I saw a lady standing in the doorway that I can see today as clearly as I saw her that night in 1978. Her name was Miss Ina, and she was standing in the doorway. Now, this was 1978, so she had this tall, brown, bouffant hairdo with curls all over. She was wearing a blue silk dress with a belt that tied at the waist. She had on patent leather high-heel shoes and her hose. She had a pair of glasses around her neck and a pearl necklace. And she held out her hand to me, and she said, "Honey, you come with me." And I went in that room and sat down, and that was my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, I cannot tell you one thing that was said that night. You know, sometimes great events happen in our lives, but we don't realize that they're great events. But I can tell you this. She gave me this One Day at a Time book that night, and she held my hand and patted it just like this that whole meeting, because I just cried that whole meeting. On the way home that night, Paul said, "How did you like the meeting?" I said, "Oh, I loved it." But I said, "But I don't think I can go back." And he said, "Well, why not?" And I said, "Because I don't know any alcoholics." Now, please understand, I have been married to several by now. My favorite uncles were alcoholic. My favorite aunt was alcoholic. My great uncles were alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. But you see, to me, it was Uncle Vernon. It was Aunt Mudd. It was my great uncles. It was my mother. At that time, I did not associate the behaviors I had with the disease of alcoholism. And I don't know what Al-Anon was like where you lived in 1978, but where I lived in 1978, this was Al-Anon. It was made up of women who had been married one time for many years to an alcoholic man in recovery who was in the AA meeting next door. And that's what Al-Anon was. And you see, that's not who I was. That's nothing of who I was. I could connect with that message so strong, but I didn't see me in those rooms. So I was in and out. I was in and out. I'd go out there and mess up. I'd run back for a little bit. I went to some other self-help stuff. I tried this. I tried that. I tried this. I tried that. Until June 15th, 1990, when I finally said, Angie, most people never find these rooms. And for those who do find these rooms, most people never stay. Honey, you are so blessed. You are so blessed. Grab hold, hold tight for the rest of your life. Don't ever leave. Be grateful. Be glad you get to go to a meeting. Be excited you get to set up those chairs. Be grateful. And since that day, June 15th, 1990, that's what I've tried to do every day, to practice a very active program of recovery and be grateful, grateful, grateful for everything that that has meant in my life. Early one morning, May 18th, 1991, I woke up and I called my two best friends, Beretta and Melody, and I said to them, would you go with me to Tuscaloosa today? You see, that precious little girl, Amanda, had grown up, and she was now a student at the University of Alabama. She played in the Million Dollar Band. And I had not heard from her in 3 months, and that was very unusual because we were pretty close, and I had had no contact with her. I've been back in Al-Anon for about a year, so I am trying to do this deal. I'm trying to practice this program. And I am waiting on God to let me know what to do. And that morning when I woke up, I knew it was time to go to Tuscaloosa. So Beretta and Melody said, yeah, we'll go with you. I lived in Dothan, Alabama, way down in the southeastern part of Alabama. And Tuscaloosa's way up in the north part. So we got in the car and we took off. And on the way, Beretta would say, well, what are we going to do when we get there? And I said, I don't know. But God's going to let us know what to do when we get there. I don't know about you, but there are times in my life, if I'm really doing what I know I'm supposed to do, if I'm practicing this program, being of service to God and my fellows, if I'm trying to live in this deal, God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. And that's the way that day was. We got to Tuscaloosa. We pulled up to the apartment complex where Amanda lived. And I need to let you know that anybody I talk about in my story approves of me doing that. So we got there, and there were a bank of mailboxes out front. And there was mail all over the ground. We walked over, and we started picking up the mail, and it all had Amanda's name on it. So we gathered that mail up, and we put it in the car. We went to her door, knocked, and nobody answered. So I said, well, I'm going to go get the apartment manager, get him to come unlock the apartment for us. And Melody and I, Beretta and I walked away, and Melody stayed there. And we were going down the steps, and Melody called out, and she said, Angie, Angie, she's here. So we turned around and walked back, and Amanda was standing in the door. And I hugged her, and I said, Amanda, I love you. And it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. We walked inside, sat down, talked for a few minutes, and then I said, Amanda, I need for you to know that I'm here to make you an offer today. And I remember thinking at the time, I wonder what the offer's going to be. Remember God doing for me. And I said, I know something's wrong. I said, I don't know what it is, but I want you to know that I'm here today to do everything I can do to help you. I'm willing to take you wherever I need to take you. I'm willing to pay whatever I need to pay. I'm willing to do whatever I need to do to get you whatever help we need to get you. And I remember thinking, oh, this is great. And then I said, but the offer's only good for today. And I remember just screaming out in my mind, no, don't make it just good for today. I said, Amanda, you know, if you don't accept the offer, that's okay. I'm still going to be your mama. I'm still going to love you. We'll go to lunch. We'll spend the day together. We'll have a great time. And then I'll go back home and everything will be great, but I won't ever make you this offer again. And I just was screaming in my mind, don't do this. And I stood up. We all stood up. My brother said, what are we doing? I said, we're going to leave her alone for an hour and let her make up her mind. And so Melody stayed there with her, and Brett and I left. And for that hour, I just cried because I knew Amanda was not going to accept that offer. And Brett said, what are you going to do if she does? I said, it doesn't matter. She's not going to accept it. We got back to the apartment, walked in, talked for a minute, and Amanda said, Mama, I accept your offer. And I said, okay. And I said, okay, God. And you know, a name came to me of a therapist that lived in Fairhope, Alabama, which is way down on the southwestern corner of Alabama. And I went over to the phone and called information and got her number and called on a Saturday afternoon. And guess what? She answered the phone. I told her who I was, a little bit about the situation. Now, by this time, Amanda told me she had written a few bad checks. So I said, she's written a few bad checks. And the therapist said, well, maybe she's got a mental illness. And I said, maybe she does. I knew a little bit about a mental illness. And I thought, you know, we can get her some good therapy, maybe get her some medication for a while, and she'll be okay. So the therapist said, let me check on some stuff. She called me back. She said, okay, have her at Providence Hospital in Mobile, Alabama at 9 o'clock in the morning. At that time, Providence Hospital had a unit of their hospital, and part of that unit was alcohol and drug, and part of that unit was mental illness. And she said, she'll be admitted on the mental illness side of the unit. And I said, okay. So at 9 o'clock the next morning, we were there, and Amanda was admitted, and I met her doctor. His name was Dr. Thomas. He has gone on to that great meeting in the sky. And Dr. Thomas said, what do you think's wrong with your daughter? I said, I don't know. She's written a few bad checks. He said, maybe she's got a mental illness. And I said, maybe she does. And I left. And every weekend for 2 months, I would go see Amanda at Providence Hospital. And every weekend that I would go, she would tell me some pretty serious things about her life, things that had happened to her, ways that she felt about me, her family, her situation, some really serious, tough things. But for me, the most serious, toughest thing was the day that she told me that she was alcoholic. You see, I had been running from the disease of alcoholism and to the disease of alcoholism all my life. And I knew I had a decision to make that day. Was I going to run from Amanda, or was I going to run to her? When I got home that day, I fell down on my knees and I took step one in a way that I had never taken it before. It was easy for me to know that my life was unmanageable. I could see the unmanageability all around me. But I did not want to admit that I was powerless. I held on to that with every fiber of my being. Boy, I didn't want to give that up, that illusion of power. But I gave it up that day. And Tuesday night, I went to the Al-Anon meeting and I asked Debbie if she would be my sponsor. And we dove into the steps in a way I never had before. Step two was easy for me. I knew there was a God. I had known there was a God all of my life. I knew God was present. But you see, my deal was to try to just live under the radar of God. That's how I wanted to live my life. Because I knew if God ever really saw me, He would not want me on this beautiful earth that He had created. He would not want somebody like me who had done the things I had done to be part of all this beauty and magnificence. So I just lived under the radar. So step two was easy. Step three was a little more challenging. Because now I'm supposed to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God that I'm trying to live under the radar of. But I figured out how to do that. I said, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. One day. I am going to do that. One day. I'm so blessed to have the sponsorship lineage that I have. And this is how one strong branch of my lineage goes. It starts with Lois, and it goes to Arbutus in Texas, and it goes from Arbutus to Lou Bell in Arkansas, and from Lou Bell it goes to Mary Pearl in Arkansas, and from Mary Pearl it goes to Debbie in Enterprise, Alabama. From Debbie it goes to me. And so when Debbie worked the steps with her sponsor, she used a study guide, and it had questions and all this kind of thing in it, 12 questions for each one. But also, because in Arbutus' day, the only things they had to use when they worked the steps with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. That's what Debbie used with me. In addition to the wonderful Al-Anon literature that had been published since then, we used that too. But we also used our foundational text. So when I finished step three, answered those questions, did it. I never told Debbie I was saying, one day. I answered all those questions. Said, I'm going to make this decision. Never told her I was saying, one day. So when we finished, Debbie said, okay, Angie, you're going to go home. And when you get up in the morning, you're going to say the third step prayer, and you're going to say it every day for the rest of your life. And when we got to step seven, she added that too. Well, when I got up the next morning and I said the third step prayer, you know, it starts, God, I offer myself to thee. And it wasn't one day anymore. It was right now. It was right now. And I knew God was seeing me. And I will tell you, for this woman, there was a while I really believed He was just going to kill me. I really did. But you see, that's how much pain I was in when I came. I was willing to do whatever Debbie said. As a sponsor of others, I remember that today. I was willing to do whatever she said. So I prayed that prayer. And I had to do it in the shower for a long time because I would just sob when I prayed it. But you know, there came a day I didn't cry anymore when I prayed it. Then there came a day I sang it. And now a lot of days I sing it, and at the end I say, God, what mission have you got for us today? Let's do it. For me, step four could have been one question. When we finished step three that night, Debbie handed me another packet, and it was about 30 pages, single space, front and back, questions, 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 questions. I said, what is this? She said, this is your four-step inventory. And I said, no, we got this study guide over here, and I read this stuff, and I answer these 12 questions. And, you know, she told me not to read ahead, but I had already read all 12 of them. I already knew how I was going to answer all of them, you know. She said, well, you're going to do that, but you're also going to do this packet. Well, we used to meet right before our meeting on Tuesday night, so I was sitting in my spot going through that packet, going through that inventory. And I was already bargaining with God because, you see, there was something I was never going to tell. I think for many of us, there's a thing or two that we're never going to tell. And I had rationalized and justified why I never had to tell it. So I'm going through that packet, and I am bargaining with God, and I'm telling God, God, I know I'm not supposed to tell Debbie this, but if I am, it's going to say, da-da, 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 period. It's not going to say, da-dee, 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 or da-da-da-da-da. It's going to say, da-da, 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 period. Well, sure enough, I got about three-fourths of the way through that packet, about halfway down that page, and there it was, da-da, 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 period. And I said, oh, God, I'm going to have to tell her. I am going to have to tell her. That's for me, step five could have been one question. That Saturday that we met, I got there early, and I watched Debbie drive up. I watched her get out of the car. I watched her walk up the steps. I watched as we walked inside and sat down. Because I knew when we got to that question, she was going to feel differently toward me. I knew that. So we sat down and we dove into those questions, and I was answering them, and we got to that question, and I answered it, and I started crying. And I was sitting down, and she came over, and she stood kind of over me, and she hugged me, and I felt something on top of my head, and it was her tears. And in that instant, the shame and the guilt that I felt about that was gone. Now, I still feel responsible about it. I feel responsible about every action I have ever done in my life, as I should feel responsible. But you know, the shame and the guilt were just killing me. And that was gone. Debbie did look at me different after that day. She loved me even more. And I will tell you also that day, I knew that God loved me too. I knew He loved me. That was step five for me. Step six and seven, I worked the way I think most of us work it. I know I did. I went somewhere quiet for an hour, and then I did those questions and did it, worked it with Debbie, and then I waited for God to fix me. That did not happen. God expects me to do my part. Sometimes I'll hear a speaker talk about all this stuff, you know, and I'll think, man, I wish I had a God like that, but mine expects me to do my part, you know. If I'll do my part, He'll do His part, you know. Over the years, I've been very blessed to discover three books, Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect, and Steps and Stories by Sandy Beach. And those three books have completely changed my life when it comes to step six and seven. As I said, Amanda stayed at that treatment center for 2 months, and the day I came to pick her up, I had a contract that I had written with me. Now, I had written the contract because in my family, I come from a long line of martyrs. You know what a martyr is. And I didn't want to be a martyr anymore. So the contract was written for me. And it said things like this. I agreed not to have men spend the night in our home overnight if Amanda came to live with me. She had to agree not to have men spend the night overnight in our home. I agreed I would buy the groceries. She had to agree to cook 3 nights a week. I agreed she could use my car sometime because she didn't have one then. She had to agree to keep the car clean and detailed. I agreed that she could live with me. She had to pay me $100 a month rent. Oh, and by this time we had gone through all that mail and I had done some other things and learned that Amanda had written bad checks to the tune of $10,000. And she was facing at least 15 years at Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama. So I had paid that money. I had paid it all off. And the contract said she had 10 years to pay me back or she would go to Tutwiler Prison for Women. She paid me back in 8 years. Okay, so there we are and we got the contract. And, you know, it's kind of like Amanda can go home with me or she's going to go to Tutwiler, you know. And I have to say, she'll say that it took her a little bit to decide, you know, mama or jail, mama or jail, you know. I have been called a black belt Al-Anon. But she did decide on mama, and I'm glad she did. And she came home with me, and we started learning how to be a family in recovery. And I'll share two quick stories about that first year. Amanda had been living with me a couple of months, and she came home one day, and she said, mama, you know, I've been doing everything you want me to do. And she had. She was working so hard. She had all kinds of part-time jobs, and she was going to meetings. And I mean, she was just doing the deal. I was so happy for her. She said, you know, I'm doing everything you want me to do. I just don't think I'm going to have the rent tomorrow. She said, I've been working hard and doing all this stuff, but I just don't think I'm going to have the $100. And so I said, well, Amanda, it's okay if you don't have the rent tomorrow. Because I went to the Salvation Army before you came to live with me, and I talked to them. And they told me I could drop you off any time, and they'd give you two hots and a cot. So I said, so if you don't have the rent money tomorrow, that's okay, but have all your stuff packed, because whatever you leave here is going to be mine. And I'm going to take you to the Salvation Army and drop you off. I'm still going to be your mama. I'm still going to love you. We're still going to do things together. But you'll never live with me again, because you will have broke our contract. And I tell you, her eyes were big as dinner plates, you know. And so I got up and went in the bathroom and got in the shower, and I just cried and cried and cried, because I knew I could do that. I knew I could. You see, there were some times in Amanda's life when I would say things to her that I wouldn't say to the checkout clerk at the grocery store. There were some times I would use a tone of voice with her that I wouldn't use with a bank teller I don't even know at the bank. There were times I'd shrug my shoulders or roll my eyes or do some kind of twitchy expression or whatever that I wouldn't do to a stranger I'm sitting next to on an airplane. But I did some of those things with her. And I knew I never wanted to do that again. I knew that day that I could see my daughter as a woman of dignity and grace, just as I could see any other adult as a person of dignity and grace. You know, one time this lady said to me, you might consider your daughter as a person of dignity and grace, but I can't see that my son that way. He has stolen from us, and he vomits, and he stinks, and he does all these terrible things. And I said, no, ma'am, you are wrong. I said, you can see your son as a person of dignity and grace just because he is a precious child of God. Just because of that. And I knew that that's how I wanted to see Amanda. I got home the next day, the rent money was on the table, and it was there every month until she moved out. This is another thing I learned that year. If my name's not in the sentence, it is none of my business. And I tell you how that works, because I still do that one a lot today. I would say to Debbie maybe something like, God, I wonder if Amanda's going to her meetings. And Debbie would say to me, Angie, your name is not in that sentence. So then I would say, God, I wonder if Amanda, Angie's daughter, is going to her meeting. Debbie would say, you cannot do that. I'm sorry. These are some other sentences. My name is not in. Does Amanda have a sponsor? Is Amanda sponsoring others? Is Amanda being of service to God and her fellows? Is Amanda working the deal? And as she has gotten older, is Amanda being a good wife? Is Amanda being a loving mother to my grandchildren? Is Amanda being a woman of dignity and grace today? You see, my name is in none of those sentences. But I'll tell you some sentences my name is in. Is Angie going to her meetings? Is Angie working with her sponsors? Is Angie being of service to God and her fellows? Is Angie being a loving wife? Is Angie being a caring grandmother? Is Angie being a kind mother? My name is in those sentences and others just like that. And I've learned in recovery that my name is in enough sentences that I don't have much time left over to worry about those sentences that don't have my name in them anymore. A couple of weeks ago, Amanda celebrated 28 years in AA, and she celebrated that at my husband. Yeah. Thanks to her program of recovery and the God of her understanding, she celebrated that at my husband's home group. And he was able to give her medallion. And it was really a very meaningful experience for us. Also, there was our adopted son of the heart, John. 3 years ago, through a series of God winks, John came into our lives. John is Amanda's mother, brother by another mother. He has been for many years. And he became mine and Chip's adopted son of the heart because he needed some parents. And we needed what he brought to our lives. I also belong to a tribe of women, a fantastic tribe of women. Women of all ages, women of all cultures, women of all races, who treasure and cherish me. And who I treasure and cherish. Who love me, who care about me, who want the best for me, and who I love and care about and want the best for. That's some gifts of recovery that have been given to me. Late one night in 1994, the phone rang, and I answered the phone, and the voice said, do you blame me because Amanda's alcoholic? And I said, what? And the voice said, do you blame me because Amanda's alcoholic? And we talked for just a minute, and I realized that it was Amanda's father, whose nickname is Slim. And I hadn't talked to him in a long time. And I said, no, Slim, I don't blame you because Amanda's alcoholic. I said, you didn't cause her alcoholism. You can't cure her alcoholism, and you can't control her alcoholism. And he said, what? I said, you didn't cause her alcoholism. You can't cure her alcoholism, and you can't control her alcoholism. He said, okay, and he hung up. About 2 weeks later, early on a Saturday morning, the phone rang, and the voice on the other end said, I'm coming to Dothan. And I said, okay, and we hung up. So then I called my sponsor, and this is what I said. Oh, my God, Debbie Slim just called, and he's coming to Dothan. I know he's coming to get clean and sober, and I don't know how to do it. I think he's supposed to use K-Row syrup, but I'm not really sure. What are we going to do? And Debbie said, wait a minute. She said, what happened? I said, well, Slim called. She said, what did he say? I said, he said, I'm coming to Dothan. She said, and? I said, well, I said, okay. She said, and? I said, we hung up. She said, Angie, how do you get all that stuff you just said from I'm coming to Dothan? And I said, because Slim knows that we are in recovery and that we have alcohol and drug-free homes, and I know that's why he's coming. And then Debbie said, oh, my God, what are we supposed to do? I do think you might use alcohol, but I'm not really sure. So you have these two Al-Anon women trying to figure out how you sober up an alcoholic, you know. And then I'm telling Debbie, I'm not supposed to do that. I'm an Al-Anon, and we're talking about that. So finally, later in the day, Amanda's sponsor called me, Precious Gloria, and she said, honey, don't you know any doctors? And I said, well, yeah. She said, well, call one of them on the phone. So I said, okay. So I got the phone book out, and it's Saturday afternoon, and I opened up the phone book, and I looked down there till I saw a doctor's name I knew, and I dialed the number, and guess what? The doctor answered the phone. I told him who I was, a little about the situation. He said he was going to call in some medicine for me to give it to him 3 days like candy, and he'd be okay. And I said, okay. And about 10 o'clock that night, Slim called. He was in Clanton, Alabama, which was about 3 hours away from me. He said, I can't come any further. He was hitchhiking from Tennessee. And so I said, I'll come pick you up. And it was really good that I had that 3 hour drive, because I will tell you, the last time that Slim had been under a roof with me was very violent. It was very violent. And you know, I was fixing to bring this man to my safe place. And you know, I've been in Al-Anon a while now, and I'm saying that third and seventh step prayer, and I'm telling God, what mission have you got for us today? But I didn't know it was going to be this mission, see. So I had a serious discussion with God. And God had a serious discussion with me. I don't get to choose the mission. I do not get to choose it. I get to suit up and show up. That's what I get to do. When I got to Clanton, Alabama, I pulled up to the BP service station. Slim was standing under the light. And I will tell you, when we were married, he was clean cut, nice looking. But you see, after we got divorced, he joined a very, very well-known motorcycle gang. And he was very successful in that motorcycle gang. So what I picked up was a guy that had on leather and chains and hair down to his waist and a beard down to his waist and tattoos that said words that I didn't even know how to pronounce. And that's what I picked up. And he threw his duffel bag in the back seat. And here we were. I took off and I said, Slim, I want you to know that I know there's alcohol in that duffel bag. We're about an hour away from Montgomery, Alabama. The alcohol's not going any further. I said, you can stay with it or you can leave it there and come with me, and I'm going to do everything I can to help you. He left the alcohol in Montgomery and came home, and I proceeded over the next 3 days to go on a journey with Slim and to learn about the deprivation and degradation and demoralization of the disease of alcoholism. The apartment was permeated with the smell of urine and sweat and feces and vomit, and I was giving him those pills, but I didn't really give them to him like candy because I was kind of afraid to do that, so his detox was pretty rough. And, you know, he took me on his journey of alcoholism because he couldn't sleep, so I didn't sleep. And this is why I tell this story. I've been in Al-Anon for a number of years now. And I would say, oh, I know alcoholism's a disease. I know it is. But I will tell you, late at night sometimes I'd be home and I'd think, I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure. I know some people that say they just quit drinking. I know some folks that just go to church. I quit smoking. I'm just not sure. I feel so blessed to be able to stand before you today and tell you that I am sure that alcoholism is a disease. I know with every fiber of my being, anytime any person on this earth says, I love you and I'll never do it again, they mean that with every part of their soul and their spirit. But I also know what a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease this is. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. That Sunday night at that time, we always had a joint Al-Anon and AA meeting together at the little clubhouse I went to in Level Plains, Alabama. And it was a gratitude candlelight meeting. And so that Sunday morning, I called Debbie and I said, I'm bringing Slim to the meet tonight. She said, Angie, you have told me the man cannot even walk. I said, he can't, but I'm going to drag him to the car and put him in it, and I'm bringing him. And that's what I did. And when we got there and turned off the main street, it's about two blocks of that little clubhouse, and the cars were lined up. People had come from Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi and Florida. You see, the word had gone out that Amanda's dad had come to get sober. And they were all there to welcome him into the fellowship. We walked inside that little clubhouse, and it was packed. It was standing room only except for one chair. And that vacant chair was between Amanda's sponsor and her grand sponsor, who was a little white-headed lady named Miss Peggy. It was about 4 feet tall. And she held up her hand to Slim, and she said, "Honey, you come sit right here by me." And he did. And he took a white chip that night. He celebrated 24 years in AA last year. He has lived the sober life that he has wanted to live, pretty much. He lives in Tampa, Florida. He has a wonderful wife named Rhonda that we just adore. And he's been able to meet his grandchildren, and he's been able to form a relationship with his daughter. Thanks to people just like you in rooms just like this. You see why I love Alcoholics Anonymous and why I love Al-Anon. Thank you. My mother never did get in recovery, but the last 2 years of her life she didn't drink because she had a COPD and emphysema, and she couldn't go to the store and buy the alcohol, so she didn't drink the alcohol. And for those 2 years, she would live 2 or 3 weeks out of the month with me and 2 weeks out of the month with Amanda. And at least 3 weekends a month, I would take her to her home in Andalusia, and she and I would spend the weekend there. I could never have done that without people just like you, ever. Because, you see, I would go to meetings, and in those meetings I would watch you, and I would watch the things you did, and I would watch how you related to your family of recovery. And in watching that family of recovery, what it looked like and what it felt like, I learned how to be a loving daughter and a loving mother and a loving friend and a loving wife and a loving sister. I learned how to accept love from a man that wasn't a sexual kind of love. I learned how to love women and not be afraid of them. I learned everything about families and relationships from watching you. One day my mother was sitting on the couch at the house, and all of a sudden she said, "I know you talk about me when you speak." And at that time I really didn't say much about her in my story. And so I said, "No, ma'am, I really don't." And she said, "I know you do." And I thought, what is this about? You know, what is this about? And then she said, "I know you talk about when I used to beat you." And I thought, oh my God, my breath just went away. And I thought, we are here. And we never talked about that. And I said, "No, ma'am, I don't talk about that." And she said, "Well, I know you do." And I said, "No, ma'am, I don't talk about that." And I'm screaming in my mind, and I don't want to talk about it now, okay? And then she said, "But I didn't beat you every day." And I turned around and I looked at her and I said, "No, ma'am, you didn't beat me every day. But you beat me many days. And one day was one day too many." And then what happened to me happened to Mary Pearl one time when she talked about she was going to see her mother, and she asked God if he would let her see her mother kind of the way he might see her. And that happened to me, and I got to see my mother, though I think God probably saw her. And I saw this tiny little frail woman who had been 20 feet tall my whole life. I saw a woman that was a country girl, led a pretty simple life, and she fell in love with a military guy, and she got pregnant, and they got married, and she was thrust into this world that she didn't know anything about. You know, she had all these books that I have today, The Army Officer's Wife and all this stuff, and pages turned down, and, you know, she tried so hard to be what she wasn't. And she was stoic, and she was hard, and she lived behind a 10-foot concrete wall that nothing was going to get in and nothing could get out of. She was a different person depending on the situation. I think that's why it's always been so important to me. I want to be the same person, whether I'm at the grocery store, behind a podium, or at home, or anywhere. But she could be a different person depending on the circumstance. I saw a woman that was alone and sad. I saw a woman that had given her life to a man that rejected her. And I walked over to her and I knelt down in front of her and I said, "Mama, you know, I have forgiven you for that." I said, "Do you remember that day I came to see you and talked about things I had done to you, steps 8 and 9? I said, "I had already forgiven you that day. I had forgiven you for every lick and every drop of blood and every bruise, everything. And I'm so sorry I didn't tell you that day." You see, when I got to step 8 and made my list, I believe everybody on my list, I had done things to, but they had also done things to me. And Debbie said, "We've got some work to do. Because you've got to work on forgiving these people before you can ever go to them and make amends. Because when you go, you've got to go with a pure heart and a pure spirit and a pure mind so that you just go with that. And whatever they do or say is going to be okay. Because because you are going with that pureness. And so I had to work on forgiving my mother for a while before I could ever go and make amends to her. And I had. And I told her, I said, I'm so sorry I didn't tell you I've forgiven you. And that's why I tell this story. I don't, for me and my recovery, we didn't focus enough on forgiveness. Once I said that to my mother and I said, I love you. I love you. We hugged and she cried, one of the very few times I ever saw her cry in her life. I know that day my mother was set free in a different way. And I know that day I was set free in a different way. I see her differently today because God has allowed me to do that. And I'm so grateful for that today. My brother was 7 years older than me and we were never close. I always wanted to get to know him better. And I know today it's because I really wanted to figure out this complex relationship that we had. I really wanted to figure out some things that had happened and what they meant and stuff. I tried to learn about sports or tried to talk to him about science. I would try to do that and it just wouldn't go anywhere. It just wouldn't go anywhere. We, at that time at my home group, we had what we called a God can, G-O-D-C-A-N. We would pass it around every meeting and the thought behind it was, I can't, but God can. So when we were finally willing to let go of something, we'd write it down on a piece of paper and we'd put it in that can and we had to let go of it and see what happened. So one night at a meeting, I wrote his name down, Glenn, and I put it in that God can. At the end of the meeting, I told Debbie, I said, well, I put Glenn's name in the God can tonight. She said, I'm so glad. I said, why? She said, because Angie, now God can work. Now God can work. Months went by. I forgot about the God can. We were at my mother's one night. My daughter and me were there. My brother and his four daughters were there. His wife, my mom, were all sitting around the kitchen table. All us girls were talking about books that we had read and what they wanted me to read. They wanted me to read the Twilight series. That's when it was. And my brother was about 56 at this time. And so out of the blue, my brother, who was just as stoic as my mother, spoke up and said, well, you know, I've never read a book. Now, this is a college graduate who had spent his career in hospital administration. And I said, you've never read a book? And he said, no. And I immediately thought, oh, where is this going? And I said, well, Glenn, why not? He said, well, the letters just get all jumbled up. Wow. And then I said, God, please help me. Please help me. And I said, well, do you have dyslexia? He said, I don't know what that means, but the letters just get all jumbled up. And his wife said, yeah, he still brings me home reports from the hospital sometimes and wants me to read them to him because he just can't read them. Well, I looked at my mother. It was obvious my mother never knew. None of us ever knew. We never knew. And then I'm just praying, God, please let me know what to say. And so I said, well, have you ever listened to a book on tape? I was trying to keep it light, you know. Have you ever listened to a book on tape? He said, no, I never have. I said, you know, I can't listen to them either. I start thinking about what I'm going to cook for dinner, what I'm going to wear tomorrow. My mind wanders, you know. I said, but if I got you one, would you listen to it? So he thought a little bit, and he said, yeah. So a few days later, I'm standing in the bookstore in front of the books on tape. What do you buy for a 56-year-old man's first book? So I bought him a James Patterson mystery, mailed it to him, and about a week later he called me and he was crying. He calls it reading. He said, Angie, I have just read my first book and it was wonderful. When can you send me another one? He just about broke me that first year. You know, they're kind of pricey. His wife says, I have created a monster. They have books on tape everywhere, in every nook and cranny. He called me one day. He was so excited. His daughter had come home from college. He said, you're not going to believe what I did today. And I said, what? He said, I bought my own book. And I was like, hallelujah, you know. And then just a couple of months ago, he called me and he said, you know, guess what I did today? And I said, what? He said, I got a library card. His wife was really happy about that, you know. What does all that have to do with recovery? It's got everything to do with it. My brother says, thank you. Thank you, AA. Thank you, Al-Anon. He's never been to a meeting. But you made a miracle happen in his life. If you're at a place in your recovery right now, maybe you're not sponsoring anybody, maybe you feel like you're kind of just stagnant and stale, don't stop doing this deal. Because you are part of miracles. Just because you don't see them doesn't mean they're not happening. The way you set up two chairs at your home group meeting last week might have put two people together that otherwise would not have talked to each other. And the things they talk about and the decisions they make may impact their family in positive ways for generations to come. 41 years from today, a woman may stand behind this podium and describe how you met her at that door right over there. Describe what you were wearing. Describe how you grabbed her hand. Describe some of the things you said to her. But you won't ever know that. Just because you're not seeing the flowers bloom from the seeds you plant doesn't mean they're not blooming. Please keep coming. Please keep doing what you do. We need you to be here. I need you to be here. For me and for my family. I said my brother and I had a complicated relationship. And there are many things that I've been learning about that relationship from that conversation that we had that day. When I asked the God of my understanding that you gave me what words to say. In 2006, I was doing a 10th step inventory. And I realized that day that I had turned over every part of my life to God, but not the part that had to do with male-female relationships. I don't know why I wouldn't give that to God. I thought I had until that day. And I said, you hadn't given him that. I had wreckage waist high by now, but I was still thinking I could do it better than God. Well, that day I surrendered and I said, God, I'm done. I am done. I cannot do this. And I know I can't do this. So I'm just giving it to you. I'm going to work on being a happy, joyous, and free woman in recovery. I'm going to do everything. I'm going to get in therapy. I'm going to do some stuff. I'm going to start going through this waist high wreckage like the book tells me to do. I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to be studying men anymore. And that's what I did for 8 years. That's what I did. I turned down dates. My friends were saying, go on loveyoulovelovelovey.com or go on kissykissykissy.net, you know? No. I've never done any of that. No. I worked on being a happy, joyous, and free woman in recovery. I also changed my spiritual life. I dove into step 11 in a whole new way. I learned how to meditate in a way that satisfied me then. I've recently learned how to do it in other ways, but I wanted a different relationship with God. See, God was a big kahuna in the sky with me, and that was fine, but I wanted him to be my buddy. I wanted him to be my friend. I wanted to be able to talk to him, just like I'm sharing with you right now. And I wanted us to be able to sit in a car together or walk in a grocery store together. That's the kind of God I wanted, and that's the kind of God I started working on getting. March 8th of 2014, I was in my house. I was going to the Flint River Roundup. I was going to host Boatee, and I walked through every room in my house, and I was just talking to God, you know, and then I said, God, I want you to know that I've done everything you've wanted me to do, and I'm ready. And I got kind of teary, and I drove to Albany, and I was rooming with some friends, and Jean was already there, and I walked in. She said, oh, what's happened? Because she could tell I'd been crying. So I told her, and I said, I walked through every room in my house, and I said, God, I just want you to know I've done everything you want me to do, and I want you to know I'm ready. And then I said to Jean, God loves me so good. I said, let's see how long it takes God. Well, Chip and I have a picture that was made less than 24 hours later by my daughter, who he calls his daughter, of us on the stage there at Flint River. And a 14-year acquaintanceship, friendship, started to change. And 6 months later, we were married. And a few years ago, I celebrated my first ever second wedding anniversary. Only in the rooms of recovery do you get an ovation for a second wedding anniversary. And we've celebrated our third and our fourth. In a few months, we're going to celebrate our fifth. When we got married, Chip had 26 years in AA, and I had 24 in Al-Anon. And my sponsor said, you know, you're starting off with 50 years. I think this marriage might have a chance here. And it's grand. It is grand. And today, most days, I get to be the woman that I always thought I could be in a relationship. But I didn't know how to be until you helped me learn. So that brings me to step... Oh, I do want to mention this. This young lady came up to me one time. She said, oh, my God, Miss Angie, are you telling me I can't date for 8 years? I said, no, honey, I'm not telling you that. I don't know how much wreckage you've got. That's just how much wreckage I had, you know. It took me a long time. I said, but I am telling you this. Don't settle. Don't settle. Don't settle. Don't settle. We know when we are settling. We hear that still, soft voice. We know something's not quite right. We know something's not quite right about what we're doing. I don't know how many miracles I kept God from giving me. I don't know how many gifts he had for me that he never has been able to give. Because I would settle and settle. Jobs, relationships, whatever. I would settle. Don't settle. This is something else I learned with Chip. You see, I thought for 8 years I was waiting on God. But you see, God was waiting on me to do the work and then tell him I was ready. And I will promise you, if you do the work, and tell God you're ready, then you better hang on. Because I have been on a fantastic roller coaster ride for almost the last 5 years. So that brings me to step 12. I've had a spiritual awakening. I've had a spiritual awakening not because I go to meetings, not because I have a sponsor, not because I look cute behind a podium, not because I set up chairs at my home group. Those things are important. But I have had a spiritual awakening because I have worked the 12 steps with a sponsor. That's why I've had it. I told somebody one time, I said, you know, to me, somebody not doing that is like going to the Pizza Hut and said, I want a supreme pizza. And as the waitress walks away, you say, oh, but hold everything but the crust. I just want the crust. Because, you know, working the steps is all the good stuff that happens, that spiritual awakening. Anyway, I digress. What am I going to do with that spiritual awakening that I've had? I tell you what this has meant to me recently. You know, I can be good in an hour meeting. I can be really good. But it's what happens the other 23 hours for me today when I'm in the world, okay? Chip and I were talking shortly after the first year, and I was thanking him for walking through last year with me. I will tell you in the years of my life that last year was one of the top five hardest years of my life. It had a lot of grief in it. It had a lot of confusion in it, and it had a whole lot of sadness in it. It's tough. And I was thanking Chip for going through that with me. I'm still processing and learning, but I'm going to tell you two quick things that I know I've learned. One is, you know, I have a bucket, and sometimes my bucket's empty, and I want to get it filled. And I would go to that empty well and try to make that empty well fill my bucket. I would put it down in the bottom. I'd beat it on the side. I'd do everything. I'd beg it. I'd plead it. Please put some water in that bucket. Water of compassion and love and all that stuff, you know. And the bucket stayed empty. I don't do that anymore. Because you see, in that field, there's all kind of wells that are overflowing with water. And they want to give me their water. That's where I go today. The other thing I learned was this. I have a bucket. And sometimes, a lot of times, y'all, it is full to overflowing. With fun and compassion and love and interest and all that wonderful stuff. And I would go to that concreted over well and try to get that water in it. I'd beat on that well. I'd use my fingernails and try to scrape a hole in it. I'd do everything I could. But guess what? My water's not going to go in that well. That well don't want my water. I don't do that anymore. I look at all those wells in that field that want my water. They're saying, Angie, over here, come on, honey, we want you. Come on, bring it here, bring it to us. And that's where I take it today. Well, we're meeting this weekend. There are meetings all over the world. Some of the meetings that I know about are there's some women that meet in a field in Africa because it's a safe place for them to meet. There's some folks that meet in a great big cathedral in London, England. There's some people that meet around a kitchen table outside of Perrysburg, Ohio. There's folks meeting in that little brick building in Level Plains, Alabama. And they're all doing what we're doing here this weekend. They're all sharing their language of the heart with each other. I'm Angie Bowdrin, and I thank you so much for letting me share my language of the heart with you. Thank you.
I could listen to this woman forever, truly. Our hands together. Make a circle. And we'll finish with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.
And I think Amanda might have something. Yeah, Amanda's got something going on. Is she?
All right, get out your raffle tickets, ladies.
I gotta do it.
All right, whoever wins this afternoon is going home with $268. All right, ladies, it's a blue ticket. 1, 7, 2, 9, 8, 6, 6, 1, 7, 2, 9, 8, 6, 6.
Thank you.